Hello and welcome to Databook. I'm Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles. And everyone out there listening is joining us at a pretty special moment. This is the last episode of Season 2 of Databook.
We will return on January 11th, of course a Friday, and we will come back better than ever.
Fortunately, that gives you a whole bunch of time to rate, subscribe, and review this podcast. One of our coolest offerings is the Peer Exchange. That's a filmed panel that we have. We bring in a bunch of KOLs into our studios here in New Jersey, and we flesh out all the really cool, important stuff, all the best ideas that are out there, and figure out where healthcare is going. And you're going to get to hear one of these peer exchanges at the end of today's podcast, so stick around.
For today's story, let's step back in time to the year 1750.
We're in Philadelphia. It's a booming city of about 15,000. And while that's only like a quarter of the size of my suburban New Jersey home in modern times, back then in the 13 American colonies, it's pretty darn big.
And Philly is also busy. You see, its piece of land on the Delaware River is lined with docks and merchants, and ships are coming and going. They're trading wine, flour, meat, you name it. And all the while, foreign merchants, visitors, and immigrants are coming in.
So there's a lot of people and a lot of movement. And it's 1750, so there's not really a lot of science, not a lot of effective medicine.
Broadly, the colonies are actually pretty healthy, at least for the time. Colonial cities are considered healthier than those in Europe. But Philly? Well, much like today, Philly is dirty.
Nice. One quote from the time describes it as a melting pot for diseases.
So more and more poor Philadelphians are getting sick during this immense time of growth.
They're getting physically ill and they're getting mentally ill. It's becoming a big, noticeable problem. And it's becoming clear that the city's leaders, they need to do something now.
So what do they end up doing?
They create the nation's first hospital. Pennsylvania Hospital.
They take an early step in a story that continues through to today. A story that may well have deep connections to the hospital of tomorrow.
So in 1751, Pennsylvania Hospital, the first U.S. hospital, gets its charter.
It was sort of a tough road to reach this point. We're talking about a petition, some backlash from rural residents who thought that this hospital would only be for city folk, and of course, fundraising issues.
A year later, a temporary version of the hospital finally opens up.
And then in February 1753, it starts welcoming patients.
Throughout the rest of the century and into the early 1800s, Pennsylvania Hospital is growing. It's building new wings, new facilities, and even a fancy high-tech surgical amphitheater.
And through all of this, the hospital sticks to its original mission. Since way back in 1751, its founder, Dr. Thomas Bond, made this one point clear.
To care for the sick, poor, and insane who were wandering the streets of Philadelphia.
But that came with an asterisk.
The hospital didn't admit people with incurable diseases.
Except for lunatics.
Yeah, or women, young children, and people with smallpox.
But for the most part, the doors were open, at least to those who wanted them open.
Patients needed two taxpayers to sponsor their stay. It was kind of like insurance, money for burial or travel costs.
Philadelphia officials, successful people in the city, hospital staffers, they all covered the tab for these folks. But the rules were there to make sure that patients entering the hospital were really, actually, truly poor.
They didn't want the folks who could work but refused to do so.
So in some way, this hospital was very much segregated. But instead of keeping poor patients out, it was meant to keep them in.
When we talk about medicine in the 1700s, we're talking about a very different field from what we know today.
So back then, Pennsylvania Hospital becomes just one of many almshouses. And these are things that are in cities and they treat not just the sick, but also the poor.
They're like kind of one-stop shops for social services. They're not very good social services, at least by today's standards, but social and medical services nonetheless.
And doctors begin to like these new hospitals because they become hubs of medical education. They begin carrying some sort of prestige.
So the American almshouse tradition presses on into the 1800s. They're caring for the poor, the isolated, and socially marginal.
But not middle and upper class people. You see, when these folks get sick, they stay home.
Their families, their neighbors, their communities, that's who provides their care.
And eventually they start hiring doctors, nurses, midwives, all of whom actually come to the patient's home.
And by the time we get to the 20th century, even poor people begin receiving home care, thanks to nursing groups that are hell-bent on public health and stopping the spread of disease.
Now, somewhere along the line, hospitals become less about helping or hiding the poor.
They run less on public funding and more on private money.
There's more science, more technology.
Getting private nurses to come to your house is getting more and more expensive.
And home care just sort of gives way to this brave new American hospital.
The Pennsylvania Hospital of 1751 and others like it, they're ancient history now. So why are we bringing it up in a podcast that's all about the future?
It's simple. Right now, we are going through a major shift in healthcare. You know, that whole digital transformation thing.
Yeah, we're talking about AI, analytics, big data, mHealth. It's all here right now, and it's all beginning to happen in a meaningful way.
But these technologies have big implications. They could change medicine, the very nature of illness.
And it seems likely that the digital transformation will also change the hospital.
And it already has, at least to some degree. Think about the emphasis placed on cybersecurity, the huge investments that health systems across the nation and the world are making in EHRs.
But what will happen to the hospital when these innovations mature, when they all start to add up?
We don't know, but our expert panel does have some ideas.
And a big part of their argument focuses on home care.
That's right. Care delivery could actually be headed back to the home, at least in some capacity.
And think of it this way. That mHealth app, that biosensor, smartwatch, or your phone, they all collect and process tremendous amounts of data.
And wearables and similar devices can instantly send those insights to a physician who can instantly return results, recommendations, whatever.
That could change the nature of care in ways that we just can't really grasp yet.
But the whole thing is kind of circular. If the hospital of tomorrow is in our homes, we do need wearables and other devices to make that happen.
And at least right now, these devices require some kind of means, you know, money.
So it's possible that middle and upper class people will once again receive medical care in the comfort of their own homes.
While physical hospitals once again house the sick, the marginalized, and the poor.
And look, that's just one possibility. The truth is, we don't know how this will all shake out.
No, we don't, and nobody does for certain. But we are lucky enough to have this expert panel of four major health tech experts.
So they're going to take over from here with a discussion on the hospital of tomorrow and the big implications and what it might look like.
We've got Gita Nair. She's a physician and chief healthcare innovation officer for Femwell Group Health and a national health IT leader.
And we have John Nosta, president and founder of Nosta Lab, a writer for Forbes, member of the Google Health Advisory Board.
And of course, we have Dr. David Albert. He's a Duke-trained cardiologist and a prolific health tech inventor whose most recent project is AliveCor.
Then there is Kevin Campbell. He's the moderator, and he is another Duke-trained cardiologist, the head of the health data startup Pacemate, and host of our very own video series, The Clinical Divide.
So let's let Kevin take it from here.
In our next segment, we're going to talk all about building the hospital of tomorrow. It's essential that we in healthcare leverage the power of big data and AI to improve care to our patients. One of the ways in which we can best implement these technologies will be through using them in direct patient care. One of the most costly aspects of healthcare today is inpatient care in hospitals. We see these rising costs in both academic and private practice settings. To that end, let's now explore how we can utilize these novel technologies to build the hospital of the future. So, Dr. Albert, I want to start with you. You know, you've got all of these technologies, all these innovations. How do we build the hospital of tomorrow? Where is the hospital of tomorrow?
Well, Kevin, my view has always been that instead of building more and more tertiary care temples of medicine, that the hospital tomorrow will be, in many ways, the home.
Interesting.
And that we will care for patients utilizing technology, utilizing AI, building on knowledge from big data, we will enable those patients to be diagnosed and treated outside of those ivory tower institutions. And I think we have to do it, if for no other reason, than cost.
I think that's a great point. How do we preserve the doctor-patient relationship in a setting like that, Peta?
I think Dave is spot on, and you know, the hospital of tomorrow is in the home, and so is the doc, and so is the nurse, and so is the patient. Whether it's remote patient monitoring, whether it's virtual visits, whether it's the doc actually coming to the household, coming to the home, assessing the home environment, socioeconomic status, along with diagnosis and treatment, there's no doubt that to make the shift to value-based care, that more prevention will be needed. Keeping people happy and healthier in the home will be key. And meeting patients where they're at, right? When we see the retailization of medicine, CVS, Walmart, absolutely, Costco, Amazon, patients are going where they are going and living in their neighborhood.
You're going to have drones delivering your beta blocker from Amazon before this is over.
Exactly.
Well, and also,
exactly,
it's not just the home, it's the workplace.
That's right.
So you have Apple is building clinics and staffing them, as do many large companies, and people love that because it improves their productivity, it decreases their time. It's just like having daycare centers.
So, Dave, remember Carl Malden in American Express? What did he say? Don't leave home without it. Remember,
that's
you
right,
always
yeah,
carry
yeah,
your American Express card. Well, for me, here it is. This is my cardio. I carry it with me everywhere because it becomes part and parcel of care. It goes with the patient. But I want to pose another interesting perspective. Let's destroy the hospital. Instead of trying to say, well, the hospital is going to move from a brick and mortar to your house, let's look at things like stage zero disease, restorative and regenerative medicine, stem cells. Think about the opportunity of stopping disease from happening at earlier and earlier and earlier stages.
Totally agree.
So for me, we look at a hospital now. A hospital is, wait for it, it's where you go to die. I mean, ultimately, that's sad, but in many instances, that end-of-life care is defined by a hospital. Walk through the wards, and you see a lot of sick old patients there. So that, I think, is intrinsically a problem in healthcare. So for me, I think that we can change that dynamic. We can address disease at, again, that proverbial stage zero. How can we find cancer at the earliest stage? How can we find an MI at the point where maybe we're looking at thromboxane, free circulating thromboxane, prior to the actual platelet plug? Who knows what the mechanism is? But I think that's going to be interesting because technology will change the need for the hospital in the first place.
No, I certainly agree with those points because I think we have to shift the focus on healthcare in the United States today from treatment to prevention. And if we can use predictive analytics and tools like this with AI in our pocket and AI leading the charge here, I think that we will be able to prevent a lot of disease. We certainly can prevent the complication of diabetes. We can prevent multiple strokes. We can prevent multiple MIs. We can prevent a lot of this just by knowing early. And that's, again, the dichotomy of big data. We use all these big data sets and the analytics, and then we personalize that care based on your
DNA.
But
I will say one thing. We're all optimists here. And, you know, when you're a kid and you say, Mommy, can I go out to play? And your mommy goes, no, honey, it's may I go out to play? The problem is we're back to the patient. I don't have to be compliant. In fact, many times I don't want to eat those vegetables. And I can be an adult and say that, not just a kid. I happen to like vegetables. But the point is we are going to have something that today we don't have much of. Personalized coaching, motivation. We sit there and I write a prescription, now an e-prescription, for you for Atenolol or for Entresto. But if you don't take it, it's not doing any good.
And if you can't afford it, and if you can't get
exactly,
it, you can't have access
exactly
to it.
And so it's best intentions do not always equal best
our
results.
Our healthcare system does not have any individual accountability placed on the patient. The patient is part of the team. There's
absolutely
doctor, there's patient, there's nurses, there's healthcare systems, but the patient needs to be held accountable
well,
some way. Otherwise,
well,
we don't get anywhere.
No, I mean, no doubt about it. But this, you know, with the rise of high deductible plans, patients are now accountable because it's affecting their pocket, right? So I completely agree with you, Dave. I mean, it's about, you know, lifestyle choices, coaching and lifestyle choices. It's also about embracing technology, particularly in the youth of today when we look at childhood obesity. Mm-hmm. For the first time, we have a generation that may not live as long as their parents. Right. That is a travesty. Right? People are not going outside to play. We grew up going outside to play. Now you're on a, you know, you're doing something on the computer. And, you know, do we need to start looking at gamification and AI and ways to keep a different generation engaged and physical and prevent?
Absolutely. And think about the suicide rates in our youth today, because they're sitting in a room engaged on a game. They're lonely. They have no human interaction. They're overweight, and it just spirals.
They're being cyberbullied.
We exactly.
That's right.
And I think that there's got to be a way that we can intervene there.
Well, I think 2 points. One is, I'm not convinced that the solution is in nudge psychology and making people eat their green leafy vegetables. I don't think that the pivotal change in care will come that way. I think it will be technology mediated through extraordinarily sophisticated diagnostic modalities that see things happening earlier and earlier and earlier. So
But the patient still has to do something about it.
And let me get to my second point. The interesting thing, and when we talk about just traditional technology today, we live in the world of the activity tracker, of the proverbial 10,000 steps. Now, the only person who really is interested in that is the guy at the gym who's looking to woo a mate, right? That's an athletic option. We need to move it from an athletic option to a clinical imperative, mediated by data, by clinical trials, by validation, exactly what you're doing with AliveCore. But the point is that if I can tell a 38-year-old woman who's status post-mastectomy for cancer that if she wears this tracker, and it's going to tell me if the cancer comes back really, really soon, will she wear it, or will it become a dust collector like so many of these other trackers? We're changing it from an option to an imperative, and I think that's a data dynamic, and we're going to see that sooner than later.
Before we go, remember that DataBook returns on January 11th. So thank you so much, everybody, for listening in for season 2.
And if you like DataBook, please remember to rate, subscribe, review, and tell a friend.
Yes, and of course, you can always visit us on hcanews.com.
So I'm Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles.
And this is DataBook.